Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. You're listening to it. You chose it. It didn't just happen to you. Welcome. Welcome to the show. What is happening? How's everybody doing? How's work? You okay? How are the kids? How's the wife? How's the husband? How's the partner? The partner? How's your doggy? How's your cat? Oh, my cat? It's funny you should ask, because I think I told you that my cat was having a little bit of trouble peeing blood. Sorry. Good morning. And it was terrifying because the cat, LaFonda, is an old lady. She's an old lady. She's 14 years old, and she's becoming more fragile. Not unlike human old ladies. Her skin feels a little thinner. She's a little lighter than she used to be. She doesn't always know what's happening. LaFonda. And I know cats get older than LaFonda, but to take her to the vet is so devastating. To both of us, really. Let me tell you who's on the show real quick. Rachel Bloom is on the show. Rachel Bloom, crazy ex-girlfriend. And she's in a new movie that's called Most Likely to Murder that her husband directed, and stars another guy that I like, Adam Pally. But she's here. We had a talk. And I guess I'll warn you now, and I'll warn you again as we get closer. There's a high level of Jew-ness happening at different points during this interview. This is a bit Jewy. If you like a Jewy, we got a little Jewy coming. Yeah, it's not over the top East Coast Jewy, but there's a nice Jewy subtext. It's nice. It's okay. You know, what I used to think was annoying about being Jewy, I believe has now become necessary. We have to put our annoying voices out there. We have to fight the power with our Jewiness, because don't want to normalize those Nazis now, do you? Nah, no, you don't. Jew it up. Bring on the Jew. Jewish Vikings. Got an email from a guy who said it might be possible. We talked about that. When did we talk about that? A week or so ago, after I was up in Oslo and Stockholm and with the Viking history. They got down there, man. They got down there into the rivers of Poland, apparently, and they were hanging out. And my brother's kind of tall. Until I get my jeans done, I'm going to go with, I got a little Jew Viking in me. Got some stocky Jew Viking in me. And now I'm going to go, I'm not a boat guy. But I got the other part. I got the landbound Jew Viking part. Anyways, what was I talking about? I do need to mention that our potter, our ceramicists, Brian Jones, has new cat mugs available starting today at noon, noon Eastern, 9 Pacific. And these mugs, these are the same mugs I give to my guests. I've got to start giving them again. I forget to get them in the new garage. Everything's discombobulated. I have forgotten to give mugs to certain guests. I don't believe Josh Brolin got a mug. You haven't heard that one yet. I don't believe Melissa McCarthy got a mug. She's coming up Thursday. But don't tell them. Maybe I'll send them. Did I give Mary Steenburgen? I don't know if she... I got to start giving the mugs out again. But they're available to you is my point. And they always sell out. So go get one for yourself. That's... BrianRJones.com/shop for the WTF custom mug jobs. Saw some guy on Twitter broke his. Sorry, pal. If I offer you a freebie publicly as a replacement, then that becomes a policy. I can't do it. But you can buy another one. And I'm not making a fortune off of these. These are nice things for the people. People like them. They're a solid mug. I saw Yakov Smirnoff last night. Said he drinks from my mug every day, and he looks at my face on the mug. But he didn't say that with the greatest tone, which is unusual for him. But I think he's mad at me because of the intros I've been giving him lately. Do you need more on that? I'm going to get back to LaFonda. I know where I'm at. So, LaFonda. So, poor LaFonda. Poor fragile old lady LaFonda. I come home from Europe, and she's got, there's bloody pee around. So, you got to take them in. She's got, it's just so sad. And now they're not, they don't even have that much fight in them. So, like, it used to be a horrendous chore to get her in the box, but Sarah got her in the box right away. But then I get to the vet, and she's just freaking out and just exhausts the poor cat. And they got to put her under just to get her x-rayed and give her tests and everything. So, I didn't know what it was. And you don't know, they're getting old, and you just sort of start to wait. Any kind of illness could be the end of it at this age. So I left her there for a couple hours. I picked her up. They did all the tests, and we gave her the antibiotic, and we didn't know if it would treat what she had. So it turns out that she's got a UTI, and the antibiotic that was already administered will do it, will kill it. Her kidneys are good. Her liver is good. Everything's good. She's got a little bit of hip dysplasia and a little bit of fused vertebrae, whatever that means. She's all right. Just got to get her fed and, get her past the trauma of going to the fucking vet. Also, please do whatever you can to support the causes that you believe in, either through actual physical support or monetary support. Whatever you got to do, whatever you think will help. Don't feel too powerless. I'm only saying this because I did some charitable contributing that I do once a year, and I can tell you who I donate money to try to fight the good fight. The ACLU gets a nice chunk of change from me. Planned Parenthood gets a nice chunk of change from me, and the Carolina Tiger Rescue and my father. That's become a charity. No, I don't want to say that. I don't want to make him feel shitty. I just gave him a little present. Because I got, no matter what I say bad about him, I owe him something, right? Like, he fed me, got me shoes, got me a car. I don't think he knew he bought me that stuff, but went through my mother. My mother was the front office. But, the Carolina Tiger Rescue. They save large cats. It's down there. I went down there. So that's, I'm just reminding people, if you can't get in, if you can't go out and do, you can't afford to support. ACLU is out there in the trenches every day defending people who need defending and standing up for what's right constitutionally. And obviously Planned Parenthood is under attack in many states, which there is an agenda to deny women of their health care rights. So do that. And if you care about tigers or lynxes or cougars of all kinds and other large cats, jaguar. How do they say it in England? It always bothers me. Jaguar, that's what I say. But I think when I see the commercial for jaguars, it's like jaguar or something weird. Maybe that's the right way to say it. What do I know? A little Jewiness came out there. So it's setting it up. I'm easing you in to Rachel Bloom, who came over. I had to familiarize myself with her stuff. It all happened in a matter of days. It just took an intensive Rachel Bloom class. And we have things in common, and it was good. You'll see. There's a new magic, folks. There's a new magic to this space. It's different, and I feel it, and there's something, it's more pure. It's a little more pure for me, this space. Not as much clutter, not as much baggage, not as much dust or weight. It's clean. It's pure. These are the interviews that are happening here now in the new garage in an undisclosed location. Rachel Bloom has a new movie that she's in right now called Most Likely to Murder. I watched it. It's good. It's available on digital download and most on-demand platforms. And of course, she's always in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Okay? This is me and Rachel Bloom.
I have a pretty good sense of what to say.
Right.
I mean, what am I preserving?
Right.
There's nothing to protect or preserve.
Nothing?
No. Well,
it's weird because I get a reputation as being that way too because I'm pretty candid on here.
Yeah.
But like, you know, and then I started to learn that there are some things like the one thing I learned is that, you know, maybe don't talk about other people. There's that one.
That's my one barrier is whenever I do interviews, it's like, what can I share? I'll share anything about myself because
right.
that's me.
Right.
But other people, it's like, I got to be really, really careful because I just don't want to hurt someone.
Well, but also like there's this weird thing where it's like, well, you know, other people were involved in this thing I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But they don't have a voice in it. If I bring it up, you know.
Yeah, they like can't argue for themselves.
If I talk about a relationship or something.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, I'm glad you had that. That's your point of view. Where do I get to share mine? Oh, you don't.
Right.
I win.
You can just write an article for The Wrap or something.
I wrote a memoir, you know, a lot about my second marriage, which was sort of a volatile relationship. But I was an asshole. I mean, that's sort of out there.
Right.
And I don't think anyone's getting sent home from work for being an asshole.
Right.
Yet.
Even though that's technically, we had a whole, I mean, every year we do a big HR meeting. I'm sure you do this with your
here
show.
Here at the house? Yeah, I do it here
yeah,
at the house.
Yeah, just here at the house.
Yeah. I hire an independent HR company.
Just to talk to the cats.
Yeah, to talk to me and the cats, yeah.
It's a thing with CBS, and they were saying that actually, if your boss is like a gratuitous asshole, that does count as workplace bullying, that California specifically.
Workplace bullying,
yeah,
right.
Workplace bullying, which I feel like if those laws had been a thing for many years, most writers' rooms before like 2007 would have gotten busted. My first writers' room was like an old school.
I've heard
mean.
Stories.
Yeah,
like the writers' room for my show, like I was in charge,
right?
And it was just me and four dudes. Like it wasn't even a big writers' room. I mean, the biggest mistake was it wasn't very diversified, and there were no women. It was just, you know, four dudes or five dudes looking at the walls, waiting for something to happen.
So what is that? So let me ask you, because I did a conversation last night. We were talking about diversity and representation. And what I was thinking was the reason sometimes there are no women or people of color on a staff, it's like you hire people innocently hire the people they know and the people who remind them of themselves, that it's kind of a tribalism thing. Would you say that's somewhat accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think with me, because I didn't have that much money to staff and my showrunners, they were a team. So there were two, right? So that left me with like two or three positions to fill with guys who I thought understood me and knew what was going on.
Yeah.
It's an excuse, but some writers' rooms have like 10 people in them.
Yeah.
And if you have that kind of network money, you can really mix it up. But it was like the first season was just me, those two guys, and one other guy and a writer's assistant.
Sure. So you want the people you know who are going to get your sensibility and get where you come from. And 9 times out of 10, those people are going to be people who are like you.
But you know what? I realize, though, I think that I could have hired a woman.
Sure.
And it would have been fine. You're writing television. And she could give that other sense to the other side of it.
That's the thing. I mean, that's what's hard is I was the only woman on my first writing staff.
What staff was that?
It was a show called Alan Gregory.
Yeah?
It was a very short-lived Fox
comedy?
Animated show.
Oh, an animated show.
Yeah, and I will say the people running it were actually very, very nice. But I was the only girl, and I was the youngest. And there is something where, you know, if you're the only girl and you're a staff writer, sure, you're like the token woman's voice. But at the end of the day, are you really going to have like, so it wasn't, let's say it wasn't the creators, it was someone else in the writer's room, like pitched an innocent, like kind of date rape joke, right?
Right.
That happens in writer's rooms all the time. That happens in stand-up comedy clubs all the time. It's just easy comedy.
Date rape, racist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just lowest
anti-Semitic.
Well, it's why like 16-year-olds tell dead baby jokes.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's the lowest.
Sure.
It's the easiest form. It's like a fart.
Yeah.
Although farts are still fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
So as the youngest person in the writer's room, am I really going to be like, excuse me, that's offensive? No, you don't want to come off as, and this is internalized misogyny, but you don't want to come off as like the crazy woman who's overbearing and can't take a joke. And so it's hard to be the token. You have to, I think if you're going to hire like the one person representing their gender or their race or even their orientation, they need to be high up. Because otherwise, if they're a staff writer, they're scared shitless.
But the bigger question is, as a comic, in that moment, it's not that you're not being paid to represent a gender. The real question is like, were you offended?
Yeah.
You were.
Yeah.
You were offended.
Yeah, but it's scary. I mean, I don't know. I was terrified on my first writing staff. My default for many years was to walk into a room, apologize for being there, and assume I didn't belong there. Like, and that's just also, I think, partially a gender thing, but also partially a personality thing. I'm a chronic people pleaser. I'm really like afraid of authority. And so I walked into my first writer's room thinking, I got hired off a 30 Rock spec. That's all I had. I mean, I had one music video out and a 30 Rock spec. And so I was
with the Ray Bradbury music?
Yeah, yeah, that was it. It was that and a spec of 30 Rock. And I walked in being like, I was 23.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh my God, I don't deserve to be here. And then some of the people on the staff were, even though they were technically staff writers, they actually had a lot more experience. It was the type of thing where they'd, because, you know, you only get bumped up if you're on a show that gets ordered to a second season. So you can be a staff writer working on many different shows for many years if you're on shows that keep getting canceled after the first season.
Yeah, right.
So some of those guys were the case, and it was a really mean competitive room. And it was the type of thing where I already went in thinking I don't deserve to be here, and then you tell a shitty joke and they'd be like, oh, good job. Yeah. Good job. And I remember one day I walked in wearing a hat that I loved. It was just a beautiful knit hat. Oh, nice hat.
Yeah.
Oh, why are you wearing a hat?
Yeah.
Is it going to rain? Yeah.
You know, certain things used to really hurt my feelings. And I think sometimes they still do, but I just kind of suck it up.
Like, what are the type of things that hurt your feelings?
Well, the hat thing would bother me.
Yeah, right. Because it's calling out the, because some of the people in the room were improvisers, and there's this thing in improv, call out the unusual thing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it comes from, is I'm going to be the straight man to this scene that is my life. But it's like, why is my hat unusual? Can't you just let me have a fucking hat?
I don't know. Like, even with the women I know in comedy and with anybody in comedy, there is a certain amount of like ball busting that goes on.
There totally is. And it's a really fine line between...
Sure, but it's different than a writer's room. I mean, you know, being in a sketch, being at UCB or being at the Comedy Store and hanging out, you know, backstage or whatever, is different than, you know, the pressure and the weight of going to work every day.
It's also context. My friends we bust each other's balls all
sure,
the time.
Right.
I mean, my writing partners and I, we are straight up mean to each other.
Yeah,
my
right.
songwriting partners and I, we're mean to each other. But we love each other. It comes from a place of deep empathy and respect and love.
Sure.
That's way different than punching down
when you're a deep insecurity.
Deep insecurity. And I mean, there's a brand of dude, and I'm going to generalize here, but there's a brand of dude who has learned to use comedy only as a weapon to assert their dominance over other people. And that's not, I'm not a fan of that. I think comedy is a way to connect and enlighten.
I think that's true.
And so it can be mean, but it has to come from a place of
Are those people professional comedians?
Yes.
That you're talking about?
Yeah.
Huh.
And in fact, this is the one podcast I've done where they actually might be listening. Everything else has been like, you know, the feminist blah, blah, blah. They're not listening to that, but they're listening to this.
Oh, so this is a stand-up that asserts his dominance to...
These are various. There's a couple people.
On stage? Like, I'm just trying to...
I'm talking more about the people I'm thinking of are more improv sketch comedians who are just very good joke writers. I mean, the type of person I've noticed that does this is...
Oh, that's different. So that's their... Yeah. That's their they got a... That's their swagger.
Yeah. Oh, a thousand percent. Right. And I always get the sense a little bit with some of them, especially now that I'm more confident in who I am, that when a woman does it, there's a little bit of like, wait, this is what I do to get pussy.
Yeah, right.
You're a woman. I'm supposed to get you with my jokes, but the pussy's being funny and I don't want to like... I can't fuck funny. Like, you know, there's... Yeah.
That pussy's going to eat my dick.
Yes, 100%. It all goes back to castration fears, which is actually a big part of a feminist film theory, that it all stems from guys. Yeah, there's this writer, Laura Mulvey. I went to NYU, where we read a lot of essays on, I don't know, sometimes nonsense.
Well, let's go. I'll make note of where we ended up here, which is castration fear, which I instinctively figured out on my own, and you were going to explain to me why it's right.
Yeah.
And then, so let's go back though, because like, you know, you do have experience in sketch and performance, but I don't know anything about you. I had to immerse myself in you. over the last week or so.
Well, first of all, this is a really big deal for me to be on here. You know, this is, comics see this as like, you've made it if you're on What the Fuck.
That's
at this point.
Crazy.
It's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And I always, in my head, when I was listening to this, when I was still like a waitress, I'd be like, who would I put on blast if I went on What the Fuck? And now I'm not in that place.
What
anymore.
Does that mean, put on blast?
I don't know. Like, what would I be like honest about? I mean, the thing is, I'm a very angry person, but I'm also terrified of being seen as crazy or angry. And so I have a lot of anger that I keep inside, which is why I love scenes where I get to play angry, because it's very cathartic.
So, we have things in common. You're clearly a Jew.
Yeah.
I speak that. Yeah, but
I heard your interview with Mel Brooks. It was great.
I became Jewish.
I started talking
like an old Jew.
Your nose got bigger.
Yeah, got big. Yeah, everything got Jewier.
You literally, by the end of the interview,
it's like, what are you? Okay, baby.
Speaking like this,
yeah, of course, yeah, yeah. I do that. Any sort of charismatic personality that I keep talking to, eventually I start to morph. My boundaries. You know, I don't know. It's a means of. I think it's an innate compulsion to connect.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I can speak that language. I can do this. What are you? Bababoof. So what? Now, you grew up in California?
Yeah, Manhattan Beach.
Manhattan Beach, which is, okay, so it's half Manhattan. Because you have I always associate Jews starting. Did your family originate in New York?
Yeah, my grandpa was Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And my father's from Boston. Mm. And my parents live their lives like East
Boston
Coast Jews. Oh, yeah, Boston Jews.
That's a unique bunch.
Yes.
The Boston Jews.
Yes.
Yeah.
The family, apparently I found out, was everyone was driven out of Boston by my father's mother, who just sounds like an overall bitch. And so
they went to New York.
I'm peacing out. I'm going to Philly. So all of the Boston Blooms are gone because slowly my grandmother, I think, drove people out is what I'm starting to hear.
But it doesn't sound like they went too far to where they couldn't have to, if they had to visit, they could take the train.
Well, if they had to visit, you know, when she dies, pick up the things that she left behind.
She was a monster?
She died when I was four. Oh. Yeah, I will say there's a song on our show called Where's the Bathroom, which is a song that the woman who plays my mother sings. Yeah. And she's an amalgamation of various Jewish mothers. And my dad called me and said, that song is literally what my mother said when she saw my first apartment. He's like, I think that you must have been there somehow in 1971 when my mother walked in.
What would she say? What'd she say?
She called it a hovel. This place is dreck. Sure. This place is garbage. What are you doing? What are you doing with your life?
Yeah. A hovel.
A hovel.
They're horrible. They can be really horrible.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I didn't have a monster Jewish mother or grandmother, but I've met them. I know who they are.
Aren't you half? Are you full?
Full.
Oh, I thought you were half. You grew up in Arizona, right?
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
But both my folks are from Jersey.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I'm full Jew.
So you had a very nice mother.
No, I mean, she was nuts in her own way. Selfish. It's a unique, they're, you know, different. It's a spectrum of selfishness is usually what you're dealing with.
Sure.
You know, and sometimes it's abusive. Sometimes it's negligent. Sometimes it's overbearing. But it usually, whatever it is, it's all about them.
Well, I think that you're getting to some. I've become very annoyed, and this is not just with Jews, it's Italians, it's everyone, when culture is used to explain away cruelty or mental illness.
Yes.
Where it's like, oh, I'm a Jewish mother.
Right. Yeah.
I'm gonna harp at you. No, you're being actually really mean right now.
Abusive.
And don't use your fucking culture to excuse that, even though it's rooted in survival. Sure. I've noticed that. Because there's a main character on our show is Filipino, and so we've talked a lot about the similarities between Filipinos and Jews and Asian families and Jewish families, and it's an immigrant culture thing. It's, you come to this country. I came to this country for what?
Right.
For you to go into stand-up?
Right, right.
No.
To live in a hovel?
Right. We escaped the Cossacks for this?
Right. And the premium that that Jews used to put on education. Yeah. You know, it's a tradition of living outside of other cultures because of the religion and being, you know, not allowed to do certain things because of that, there was always this premium put on, you know, becoming the best,
so
you can show up for, you know, where they can't argue with you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, well, it relates back to, if you're the one woman at like a, you know,
right,
doing a set,
yeah,
you're doing it on behalf of all women. If you bomb, there's someone in that audience who's going to go, women aren't funny because of that one person. You won't have a person say men aren't funny because that one person bombed. There's something about
anyone
who's in the minority, whatever you call minority, is always, you're representing your
right
culture.
And but the other side of that, is it your responsibility?
No.
Right.
But it, like it or not, with ignorant people, it sometimes is.
Are you getting anything like that? I mean, how does my crazy ex-girlfriend, how does
crazy
that...
ex-girlfriend, there's no my.
Oh, yeah, crazy ex-girlfriend.
The only reason I correct people is because my makes it possessive, and it makes it from a male gaze point of view. I
dig it.
Yeah.
Crazy ex-girlfriend. I don't want to be accused of male gazing.
You can't help it.
Of course not.
Yeah, men are. It's the way that your brains are programmed. Men and women are different. It's okay.
Oh, really? Have you used that as a topic?
Yeah. Well, I've talked about this in other places, but I'm curious as to what you think. I heard a story on NPR a couple years ago of a person who was transitioning. They were a woman and they were taking hormones to become a man.
Yeah.
They get on the subway. They started testosterone. They get on the New York subway. Suddenly, they see this person sees a hot woman.
Is this a parable?
I know, right? It sounds like, and the rabbi put three more goats in the
right,
house.
Yeah.
They get on the subway and they see attractive woman and suddenly get the urge to like fuck this woman. And he starts
transitioning.
The person who's transitioning
to a man.
Yeah, and he realizes, oh, is this what testosterone does? And I talked to a lot of my friends about this, including my husband, and they were all to varying degrees like, yeah. Like when I walk into a room and I see a hot guy, maybe I'll register it, but it's not this involuntary whoa. But apparently
but what makes you do that? Is it talking to somebody, or like, I mean, hot is very, you know, subjective.
Hot's really subjective. I think for me, I have to get a vibe. I have to catch a vibe.
Yeah, okay.
I gotta catch that vibe, but it's not purely physical. It's why women don't wolf whistle at men on the street. That's not how our brains work, but the way that it seems that a lot of men's brains work is my husband described it where it's like you'll see a hot woman and in the back of his head, it's like a little voice just goes, pussy.
Yeah.
Pussy. And it's involuntary. But another friend described it as you'll get an involuntary like camera flash of like, boom, picture me fucking her in the shower. And then it goes away. You tell me.
Unless you continue the scene.
Unless you continue the scene. Or unless you're actually fucking her in the shower. Yeah.
No, I mean, like, those things come, and you have a certain amount of control over how long they go on for.
Right.
But I mean, I think on some level, the pussy thing is right, but it's also, it's the same thing that goes on where it's like, there's the other one is food.
Right. So I get that when I see, I'm a big fan of roller coasters.
Yeah.
And I've realized it's the same thing when I see a video of a roller coaster on TV, or if we're driving past an amusement park.
Yeah.
The way I treat roller coasters is the way I think my husband
thinks
about women.
Well, I think there's something very primal about it and very, you know, biological about it. And, you know, being civilized people who have self-awareness, you know, you kind of keep that shit in check. But I think that it's undeniable, but not in any way an excuse that, you know, that we're put here on some level to fuck.
Yeah, of course.
and that's, you know, always that part of the brain is always sort of like, are we fucking? When are we fucking? Is that going to happen soon? Where is it? I think, you
know. It's how we make more people.
Yeah, it is.
It's how we survive. It makes sense.
And I haven't made any more people. But that, no, I think they would have come out by now.
Okay.
I think I would have met them.
There's still time.
Sure. Oh, for me to have people?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. I know. I don't know. It seems like... just thinking about it, I'm worried about the kid. Like, I'm worried now. Like, you know, why don't you have children? He's going to go to school by himself? So, like, I don't, you know, I...
What do you mean he's going to go to school by himself?
That eventually you have to watch this thing and like,
I thought you meant, like, for whatever reason, your kid is going to be, like, alone in a school.
He is going to be alone. Like, I mean, he's got to go at some point.
No, but, like, no other students.
Oh, no. No, it's just, like, the worry thing. I'm an anxious person. I have, like, severe panic and anxiety issues.
It's very paternal to automatically think that you're not, like, oh, kid, responsibility. You're like, oh, no, I'm going to worry about him. It's very sweet, actually.
Yeah, but it gets overbearing. Like, you know, there's you know, worrying is not love.
You know,
like
you don't, no?
No, because I'm like, because it's sort of like, how am I going to deal with if something, what am I going to do if something happens to that kid? How am I going to handle that?
Oh, it all goes back to your feet, like a fear of, in a way, like, God forbid that kid should die. Your life is over.
It's something.
You won't be able to recover.
Right. Because I'm making up a kid.
Right.
Right. So it's he's got no hair color. Or I don't know his name, but it's just the idea.
I think his
is
name's
sort of,
Alex.
Okay. But the idea is that, like, I'm responsible,
mm-hmm.
and so much is out of my control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if something happens?
Mm-hmm.
And it happens.
It's the same thing with cats, though.
I know, and it's terrible.
I think that's probably why you feel it a little bit.
It's terrible.
Right?
Well, it's just I don't know. It's just too much anxiety. I like kids, and I'm always, you know, I like to communicate with them.
Yeah.
And I like to see them, but I just the day to day of it. But people seem to lock into it. Are you having them?
It's a debate. It's a conversation. I mean, I emotionally want them.
What is that? Emotionally versus what?
Well, it's logistics. It's
a
lot of emotional things on my end and my husband's end. And I mean, it's hard. Having kids is fucking hard. I mean, I work 16 hours a day. For half the year, I work 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
I couldn't have a kid right now.
Right.
I mean, if I did, I would never see them and they would grow to resent me. So there is a certain sacrifice and give and take. Plus, there's the wild card of, if I want to have a kid, I don't know what I'm going to be like when I'm pregnant. I don't know if I'm going to be able to function or if I'm going to be super sick. I don't know what my postpartum is going to be like. It's literally...
So we're exactly the same. Yours is just a little more complicated.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's my body.
Yeah, but like...
I fear the bad post. My mom had very bad postpartum and she was very sick and I'm...
Postpartum that lasted your entire childhood?
I guess so, that she's still going through. No, I mean, it was hard for her because she had bad postpartum and then her brother was killed in a car accident. So
I think
a lot of those things compounded. But I've heard horror stories from other people about postpartum and it's just the way it fucks with your body. And I have a whole thing where it's kind of boring, but I have this whole thing where, like, I can't be on a birth control with estrogen because it makes my tits hurt half the month. And I have a really sensitive system anyway. So that's a whole other thing where, what's it going to do to my body? What's it going to do to my mind?
The kid.
Just being pregnant.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah. No, I can hear that. I mean, I believe you.
Yeah.
But I mean, but you know, and I know that some people just do it.
Well, a lot of people do it.
Yeah, like a lot.
Like, most people do it.
But what I'm sensing is that whatever desire you have to have them is being overridden either for emotional reasons or practical reasons. Whatever the reasons are, the case is being made against having them.
The case is... Well, look, logically, it makes no sense for anyone to have a kid. I think that's the ultimate thing.
In what way?
It costs money. You're raising...
these are practical.
You're,
it is not,
just, yeah. I'm just saying purely practical.
Okay.
If you take out the emotion.
Right.
It doesn't make logistical sense to suddenly spend all this money to raise this person.
I don't think it costs much more than a pet till they're like 11.
Okay, but also effort.
Yeah.
Because you're up at all hours of the night. You give something unconditional. Well, this gets into emotion, but you give something unconditional love that they may never...
It's always conditional.
...return.
Always becomes a conditional.
I know. Obviously, yeah. I think I do. I mean, it's just... I want it. The weird thing is, I say I'm afraid of being pregnant. I actually want to be pregnant.
Yeah.
I love feeling I love feeling my friends' pregnant bellies.
You do?
I love it. I love looking at ultrasound pictures. I love feeling where the baby is. Yeah. I've always been, as a kid, I was an only child and I was a weird only child. I would like pretend I was pregnant when I was like 4 or 5, and then I would take a shit and be like, I'm giving birth.
Yeah. You wanted a brother, maybe.
I did. I had imaginary imaginary siblings.
Really?
That I would fight with.
So you were only child.
I was an only child, and my imaginary siblings were Kevin McAllister from Home Alone.
Yeah.
Wednesday Addams.
Uh-huh.
And Pippi Longstocking.
Oh, Pippi. That would be fun.
Yeah, but I would fight with them.
You'd fight with your
siblings. And then I'd make my parents, I'd be like, Pippi's being mean, and I'd make my parents come in and mediate. I would go, Pippi, stop.
They would do that for you?
Yeah, they would.
They'd play along?
Because
why didn't they have other kids? You don't know? They just wanted one? Or?
I, I, I honestly think my mom had a really tough pregnancy. Uh-huh. My dad was 42 when I was born.
Oh, wow.
I just know he got a vasectomy pretty quickly after
I was
born.
Oh, yeah, they got it done.
He got that shit done so now, he could always, come in my mom.
Yeah, for, not worry about
not worry about it.
Look at me coming in you. All right, so let's go. Let's try to get up to because I want to talk about how it happened for you, because I think that you and not unlike you and me as well were part of a new media thing.
Yeah,
that I think made a lot of other people think, oh, I could just do it that way.
Yes. Yeah.
So you grew up in Manhattan Beach and you went to high school here.
Yeah.
And you did high school theater.
Yeah. I had a very good theater department. And it was weird growing up in Manhattan Beach because I was an anxious kid I was obsessed with musical theater and thought about death, but was also very outgoing and was raised by neurotic Jews who, you know, always talked about skin cancer. And so I was. And plus I had
skin cancer?
Yeah. Do you get your skin checked?
I do. I had a basal cell on my nose.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah, they had to cut it. It was a real procedure. That's not a deadly one.
No.
But it's like, it's a thing. And I thought like you just get it removed like a mole, but no. They made a hole in my face.
Yeah, to get out the, I don't even see anything.
Well, if I really pointed out to you, you would see it. Like they do a Mohs procedure where they keep taking out a thing. They cut a little bit out and then they go test it. And then if they didn't get it all, they cut again. But you're just sitting there in the waiting room with gauze stuck into a cauterized hole that's numbed out.
Do it in the same day. So you're sitting there. Oh, that's
each time,
disgusting.
Each time. And like they went three or four times, and then I'm like, can I see what's going on? And the doctor's like, we don't recommend that you look at it at this point in time because it's numb.
Yeah.
And I go look in a mirror. I'm like, I said, I got to see what you're doing. There's like this nickel-sized hole on the side of my fucking nose. And I'm like, can you fix that?
Holy shit.
And then, of course, the doctor with their cute fucking sense of humor is like, I think so.
Ugh.
You think so. Anyway, so you're saying you were brought up by neurotic Jews full of panic and you had anxiety problems. And morose thoughts.
Yes, doctor, yes.
Well, you've processed this.
Oh, 1,000%. It just sounded like I felt like I was suddenly in a very good therapy session.
You're in a pretty good therapy session.
Pretty good.
I'm not a professional. But
after doing all these interviews, I think you might as well be.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've gotten emails from psychologists.
Do they like the show?
They think it's helpful. Yeah, some of them, like, well, they think that I do a good job. But I'm not a clinical, you know, I'm spitballing.
Of course.
I'm spitballing that you're a little fucked up.
That would be accurate. Yes.
See, there you go. All fixed. But like the morose thoughts though, because I remember what I was going to ask you. I always have this theory about only children, but none of them have validated it for me. Was there extra pressure because you were the only one?
Yes and no. I mean, I was so, and this is more relating to anything artistic.
Yeah.
I was so encouraged and adored with artsy stuff.
Oh, good.
That it gave me confidence, but then it became my identity. Which happens a lot with musical theater people too. In general, your talent, your art, your craft becomes
the community
yourself,
too, right?
Your self worth, yeah.
Now, were your parents creative artsy types?
My dad, no. My dad's a lawyer who loves health law.
Health law,
like the way we love comedy. He's obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And my mom was a music major and is a pianist and sang in choirs. So yes, and then my grandpa. Was an amateur. My grandpa sold technical manuals, but on the side, he directed and wrote and acted in community theater.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He was the one, we have all these videos where he's teaching me all these old songs and he pushes me, do it again. But it was all professional.
Grandpa.
Yeah, my mom's dad, who was from Brooklyn, who I spent a lot of time with.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
And he lived a long time?
He lived to be 80. He died when I was in college.
Oh, so you had a full life with him.
I did.
That's great. Yeah, I had that with a couple of my grandparents.
Yeah, but it was complicated. You know, as it is with all Jews, I think it was lovely, but also he had a really bad temper. I mean, I heard that when he directed community theater, he would make his actors cry. He would just scream at them if they were a minute late.
But not with you.
Oh! Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes he would yell at me if I wasn't wearing shoes in the house.
Yeah, my grandfather had a heart attack by the time I really got to know him already. So he was on Librium, which was pre-Paxil. It was a sort of like a, just kind of kept him level a little.
Oh, yeah.
So like he was more cranky than my mother claims that he was just a raging lunatic. But yeah. By the time I met him, it was sort of like, are we leaving? You know, it wasn't, and he was just very placated.
I think it was the same with I think my grandpa, my mom, but he hit my uncles.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, that's what you did in the 50s to discipline kids. You hit them with belts and shit.
Now you're doing what you're...
What am I doing?
You're
that's what you did in the 50s. Listen, it was a different time. I have one uncle who lives in Northern California and just completely isolated himself.
Oh, he ran away from
the family.
There's always one of those.
Yeah, there's always one of those who's just like, I'm out, peace out,
yeah,
I'm
yeah,
gone.
Yeah, they probably don't even identify as Jewish anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's into, he's a mystic.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Jewish mystic.
He's a Jewish mystic.
Sure.
It's a thing. He makes metal geometric objects and speaks to spirits through them. That's literally his religion.
Yeah, but it's not Jewish.
No, it's not Jewish.
It's just a guy who has a strange... compulsion that
well
or is there a
it's his calling
to,
it's it,
did,
I think there is a system
okay.
There are other people, there's like a guru and there are other people. I mean, but would you, I mean, if you weren't Jewish or say you had no religion, I mean, Judaism's weird in that you can be an atheist like I am and still call yourself
cultural identity
Jewish.
Yeah,
right,
yeah, right.
It's a religion and a race and a culture, I guess.
I don't know if it's a race, is it? I've had that question before. Have you thought about it?
Well, I've done 23andMe and Ancestry.com, and it says my race is 98% Ashkenazi Jewish.
I got to do that. But
be prepared to be underwhelmed. You're just going to be 100% Jewish. There's not going to be anything interesting.
No?
No.
My brother's kind of tall. I come from Russian-Polish. That's what.
Yeah, that's me too.
So, okay, so you're...
Jew.
A Jew and musical theater. So that you're doing that very young?
Yeah.
That's what you're telling me?
Yeah, yeah. And then I went to school. I wanted to be on Broadway. And so I majored in musical theater at NYU and quickly got disenchanted with it.
But how big of a problem was your mental problems?
I learned to be a very good show pony. So I think people didn't know what was going on. That's like a, you know, it's like I'm a,
I know,
I
get,
yeah. It's, so I, like, I learned to cover it. And
you can turn that shit on. I can see it on the show. I can see it on stage.
Oh, yeah.
You're just one of those people that, like, if there's a, if everyone's sad in a circle, you're going to like, wait.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. When I'm.
We're mourning here.
He had a great life. It's fine. He was 16. So.
Let's sing a song.
Come on. Put on company.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you do is you power through. And in some ways, it's good because cognitive behavioral therapy is all about deciding, you know, what anxious thoughts do you
engage
in. Right.
But you're sort of backloading that.
Oh, yeah. 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 It was all going to come to a head.
But no, I'm just listening to you because I did the same thing. Like, you know, I just plowed along. And because I had a very sort of... not aggressive personality, but like my parents were not, they were just sort of like, oh, that kid's okay. He's going to be okay. That one's going to be okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't really okay, but you know, I ended up doing comedy. I ended up like pushing ahead. And a lot of it was because I didn't buckle, you know, like that there's something about that persistence. I guess you could call it creativity or what, I don't know what it is, but I think what you're talking about that I like is that it is cognitive because it's survival, you know, because, you know, either you're going to, but didn't you fucking, like, I'm thinking about myself, and didn't you fucking spin out and lose your fucking mind and end up in the goddamn college health center and breathing into a bag or what?
I mean, it was slow. I think I've always been so afraid and aware of keeping up appearances that even at my lowest, I always wanted to seem normal.
Uh-huh.
So there were definitely... I mean, moments in college where I spun out. And that also has to do with romantic stuff. And I mean...
But you never thought you were dying or any of that shit?
No, I never thought I was dying. And I've never really had earnest thoughts of
suicide.
Of suicide.
Right.
Suicide.
No, just...
And I think that's... I don't know what that is. I mean, I have a friend who One of my good friends, since he was a kid, has had thoughts of suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, he would open up the drawer yeah. in his parents' house and like look at the knives, and but he on the outside had this great life, and I'm not to say my life hasn't been great, yeah. but I'm kind of the opposite. That there's something underneath all the stuff that's really sunny and happy and positive, and there's this the idea of just ending it. I'm like, oh, but it'll get better. Despite right. everything. And I don't know where it comes from or what that is.
Like, I used to do a bit about that. But, like, I think about suicide all the time. It's not because I want to kill myself. It just makes me feel better knowing that I can if I have to.
Sure.
So it's actually a cognitive stress relief.
Do you think that
tool.
To soothe yourself? Like, well, if nothing else, I can kill myself.
I used to. Yeah. Oh, fuck yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was, like, such a go-to. I think that's what's there in place of the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That what's in, like, my inability to suspend my disbelief enough to turn anything over to God is just sort of like, I could always just make myself die. But I think that is the hole that most people are like, you know, it's a spiritual void, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for many years, my spiritual void was filled with this kind of, not Jewish mysticism, but as much as, like, I would say, like, privileged white person, like, well, the universe cares about me. So anything that, you know, goes wrong happens for a reason. And you tell yourself, like, it all happens for a reason.
Yeah.
And when I'd be shitty to other people or something bad would happen, I'd tell myself, well, this was meant to happen. And then I remember the moment in college. I remember the moment in college where I'd already been reading Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, so I was kind of primed for it. I went, wait, what if it's not meant to, just for a second, what if there's no fate? What if I happen to exist?
Yeah.
And when I fuck up, I just fuck up.
Yeah.
And when I'm inconsiderate to people, I'm inconsiderate. When I'm irresponsible, I'm just irresponsible. And it's actually to the detriment of myself, and I can learn from it. But at the end of the day, it was a mistake. And that was the moment I became a practical atheist, and I became a better person in that one moment. So my spirituality, it happened to me in this moment, kind of the way other people describe finding Jesus.
Yeah.
Losing Jesus, or losing whatever
that
cushion was that allowed me to not be the best version of myself.
The self-centered, rationalizing universe thing.
That allowed me to also be lazy.
Well, that whole thing, like, nothing happens that's not supposed to happen, is all relative to your perception of things. And that's where everybody gets sort of fucked up with their ego and narcissism, is that all those kind of little trinkets of spiritual awareness are really relative to your perception.
Yes. Also, it comes from a place of, for me, it came from a place of privilege. Because, okay, so I'm a fucking, like, upper middle class, you know, white person in America, majoring in theater with no student loans.
Right.
Of course I can tell myself that everything that's meant to happen happens for a reason, that my life will be okay, because 9 times out of 10, my life is going to turn out okay. But it's so fucking selfish of me to, like, think that was someone, I don't know, living in a fucking destitute area who's dying of dysentery. Like, everything happens for a reason. What a privileged fucking thing to think about.
Sure. Well, the other version of that is God has a plan. And
what's your plan, man?
Yeah, I know.
Show me your five-step. Show me your, what's your five-year plan, God?
I don't even have time to think about it.
I know.
You know, like, that's what that, you know, the idea of God and all that, when people are like, I don't even think about it anymore. So,
yeah.
So atheism is practical.
It makes you take
responsibility.
Yeah. And that's why I say I'm a practical atheist and a theoretical agnostic, that the way that I live my life day to day is taking full responsibility for my actions and being a nice person just to be a nice person. It doesn't relate to what governs the universe. To me, the two things are completely separate.
Yeah.
So I would never claim, we know very little about the universe. There might be a teenage alien running this computer simulation that we're all living in, but that has nothing to do with how I live my life.
That
shit's crazy.
I don't do it. What do you know? It's crazy. I mean, what am I going to waste my time with that? I can't break it down that much to believe that.
No.
Do I want to spend an hour with a person selling me on that idea that this is all a hallucination, or we're just part of some simulation? Do I want to be convinced of that? So I could do what? What happens then?
Nothing. That's why it's all theoretical.
But it adds anxiety. Because if I get to a point where I'm like, wow, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, now what?
I think it's just interesting. I mean, it doesn't actually change anything. I'm still, I'm still existing and I'm still feeling. I think it's, I don't know. It okay. doesn't freak all me right. out anymore.
I'm not freaked out by it. I just don't have the time for it. My brain won't do that
well,
anymore.
You're busy.
I guess, but I mean, I think about things, but just not that.
Well, maybe you also subconsciously know that, or consciously, that if you start thinking about it, you're going to spin
out. No, but I'm more concerned about, you know what is happening to our brains that are being sort of maneuvered by stimulus that diminishes our ability to think for ourselves, use our memory, and you know, maintain our attention span.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm more concerned with my relationship with my phone.
Dude, it's all I discuss with my psychiatrist. the phone shit. He's on me about the phone shit, the social media shit. It's especially, I don't know if you, but I don't have ADHD per se, but I have ADHD tendencies. I might have slight ADHD, I feel the phone sending dopamine to my brain and just getting me addicted and making me dumb.
Yeah. Well, it's your engagement with it. The phone is like, it's like, you know, looking at good comments and then bad comments. It's a speedball. My thing now is just like compulsively reading news.
Sure.
What are we doing? We're talking about your life. So, but what do you have?
What do you mean?
Your fucking problem?
Oh, I have, I guess, what's my diagnosis? I have low-grade depression with varying
dysthymic.
Anxiety. Yeah, I don't know. I have like low-grade depression with varying anxiety and like a, you know, anxious and OCD tendencies with a little undercurrent of ADHD.
I don't know about the ADHD, but I have all the other ones.
Yeah, it used to
I
be worse.
I have the exact same thing. The minor OCD, that helps comfort me people.
So OCD, the way I have it is different from the, like, I'm going to wash my hands.
Right, how do you have it?
My OCD is all looping thoughts, and it always ends in the fear that the OCD or the compulsive thought itself is going to ruin my life. That the thought itself is going to attack. So
example.
Okay, perfect example. All right, we're pitching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yeah.
The night before we pitch, I don't sleep at all.
Yeah, of course.
And it becomes this thing of, why aren't you going to sleep, you fucking bitch? You know, go to sleep. And I wake up. That whole week I have horrible insomnia. And insomnia makes anything you have a lot worse.
I don't have it anymore. I know what you mean.
It's so bad. Yeah, so then I get over that. But the next time I have insomnia, I happen to be in New York, it reminds me of the time that I had insomnia, and it sends me to a bad place of worrying if I'm going to have bad insomnia again.
All right, like seeing the sunrise kind of shit. Like, you know, like, I don't want
to
fucking...
I can't do this. Then obsession with, you can't control when you go to sleep. Sleep is the most fundamental thing, but when you actually think about it, sleep is the act of letting go. It's the act of not controlling anything, which is crazy if you are someone who needs to control something like me. And so I began to just spiral about sleep, and then it began to kind of haunt my every waking moment where I wasn't thinking about, even when I wasn't even worrying about the night. I was fearing the night.
Wouldn't be able to go to sleep.
Because I'm going to be alone. I'm going to be alone with my thoughts. And this is before I started meditating and shit. I'm going to be alone with my thoughts. I'm going to be alone with the fact that I can't get to sleep. It's going to be terrible. And it just began to kind of haunt the day until it was this overall feeling of dread. And then I thought, oh my God, I'm always going to feel this feeling. When is this feeling going to go away? And then in the middle of it, my boyfriend proposed in the middle of this thing that I was going through. And I thought, oh my God, whenever I think of my boyfriend now, I'm always going to think about this bad feeling that I had during this thing, and it's going to ruin my relationship, and it's going to attack everything. And it just was this, it becomes this trying to outthink the anxiety. And that's the form it takes and still takes, is this feeling of, it feels like there's this dark thing that if I let it take over, it's just going to ruin everything.
Dread.
Even though I know that's a hyperbolic thought, but it feels like when I'm about to have a little anxiety spiral, it feels like I'm walking on the edge of a swimming pool, and I'm fine. But if I even dip my toe into the thought, if I even form the question, I'm done.
I know. I have that. It's dread.
Yeah,
dread.
It's like existential dread that leads into my fear of failure.
Right. But that's like, that's just a manifestation of the anxiety. Like, you know, it takes you out of the present. It makes you live in your brain. And I don't, you know, good for your boyfriend, who's now your husband, to be able to to sort of, he must ground you somehow, because yeah. I mean I have similar things where I've been, just with age somehow or another, I know myself well enough to where I'm like, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, cause I've gone through hypochondria, I've gone through, you know, whatever the fuck it is, where, you know, I do get panic, but usually there's some foundation for it,
mm-hmm.
you know, in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And I can spin out like that, but like, it's not as hypothetical as it used to be. So what happened though, when you went in to pitch it, were you?
I was fine.
Oh.
Because I'm a show pony. It's always fine. That's the thing, is it's...
You got to lean on that. I guess you're learning how to do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always fine.
You're
it's
a professional,
never,
yeah.
It's never going to be what I'm fearing, because I've spent 31 years doing this.
Right, exactly.
So it's a matter of outsmarting it, but not outsmarting it.
Do you ever think it's part of your process? Have you gone down that road? What would I do without this? Like, there's got to be...
No.
Because...
I don't feel like myself when it's happening. There's a
but
different...
there's something comforting about it if you've been doing it all your life.
No, it feels like I'm trying to outsmart it and solve it.
Oh.
That's what it feels like. It feels like I'm trying to solve something. I'm trying to solve the unsolvable. I'm asking questions that have no answers.
I know, but that particular pattern...
It's how my mind works, and it definitely relates to being creative. I think it's the dark side of my creativity.
But don't you ever think like, oh, I don't know, it sounds like your parents were okay. Why are you such a control freak?
Well... Remember when we were saying, here's the thing. Let's just say there are, I can talk about my experiences, but when it comes to certain things, in general with my family, there are certain people I don't want to upset.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, how bad was it?
Everything's great.
Show pony. What, are you gonna sing a song now?
Everything is fine.
So, but okay, so you go to Tisch.
Yeah.
And that's the hard school.
Yeah.
And you didn't love it there? Why? What happened?
Well, when you major in musical theater, first of all, everyone who majors in musical theater were all the leads of their high school plays. So you get there and it's a bunch of other like silverback gorillas who are like, well, I was Fantine. Now I was Fantine. And also musical theater kids, young musical theater kids are kind of the worst,
yeah,
because they're all like comparing voices. Everything is like, who's the best actor? Who's the best dancer? And it's just like, it's terrible. And it was also that I was immediately faced with people who were more talented than I was.
Oh.
And that's terrifying when your whole self...
For real, though, or just, I mean...
Yeah.
Do you look back on it and you think that, or do you look back on it they just had more together? I mean, you're pretty talented. I mean, what would determine that?
But it's like a binary technique thing of this person's voice literally sounds better.
Oh, okay. Right.
And this person has more control over their instrument, whatever.
Right, right.
Whatever,
okay,
that
I get it.
Means. And so there was a part of me that felt like I didn't fit in,
mm-hmm,
that I was kind of tired of people's personalities. And also then we started to... When you start to study musical theater, some of it is brilliant. When musical theater is good, it's the best thing in the world. When musical theater is bad, it's the worst thing in the world.
Mm.
And I just began to, I don't know, I just, something didn't feel right. And so I auditioned for the school sketch comedy group and I got on and I very quickly like fell in love with
that.
Sketch comedy. I mean, it was the quickest I've ever fallen in love with anything. I remember writing one of my first sketches on a lunch break, mm-hmm, at musical theater school, like on the floor in my ballet shoes. It's all I suddenly wanted to do. I became obsessed, and I think part of it was because it was a new skill. I didn't have my ego wrapped up in it, so I was okay to be on a group with a bunch of people who were more talented than I was, because my ego wasn't wrapped up in being the best comedian. So
right.
I was finally, for the first time, free to try my best at something.
Oh yeah.
Fail and be okay with that.
Yeah.
And so, in musical theater school, I started to subconsciously not try. First of all, because I wasn't getting a lot of sleep. I mean, I've had sleep problems since I was a little kid that I only in the past couple of years recently dealt with. So I was getting 5 hours of sleep a night, and so I was exhausted and kind of wigged out. But also, I wasn't trying, because if I then wasn't good at a song, I could say to myself, well, I could have, I mean, if I wanted to, I could have done
that. I used to do a joke about that, like, sort of like, I don't prepare, you know, because, like... If it goes well and you don't prepare, you're a fucking genius. If it doesn't go well, you can just be like, nah, I didn't prepare.
Exactly. And it's so great when you don't prepare and it goes well, because then you start to tell yourself, well, that's just my process.
Yeah, right.
I don't memorize my lines. That's just my process.
And then, but the problem with that is, like, you keep doing that and, you know, you keep having success. At some point, you realize, like, oh, I'm the only one who thinks this is good.
Yeah.
Like, it's like there are people who are like, she's not really that good. And you're like, but I'm so honest.
Oh, yeah. I took an on-camera acting class and I was doing the thing where I hadn't prepared much and it was just coming from impulse. And then I watched it and it was garbage. Absolute trash. And I was like, oh, I need to start preparing. Shit.
But you were in it though, right? You felt like you were nailing it when you were doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, it feels so true and so pure. So what if I'm not getting the lines? Doesn't matter.
That's an important hit to take.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. So you like the improv and you do it. And what'd you drop out? Or you finished? No, you finished.
No, I finished. Yeah, and then.
You're not going to quit.
No. I mean, it was a weird thing where I was on the sketch group and this is a whole other thing, but I was one of the only girls on the sketch group and I was really young. I was a very young 18. Like, I hadn't drank or smoked or had sex. And the older guys who were my directors started flirting with me and hitting on me, as it happens. And I got kind of unwittingly involved in this like love triangle that then, because they were young too. I was like 19 and they were 20.
The improv
24.
Group people?
Yeah, the sketch group people. I was supposed to be the director of the group, and because I got in this love triangle and fell in love with one of them, but the other one also loved me, and then like I dumped one of them but continued to see the other, I got removed as director from my college sketch comedy group. So this was a...
By them?
Yeah. So it was like a defining moment for me, because I think that the way I learned comedy for the first year or two was just almost doing an impression of what those guys were doing. And when this whole thing happened, I said, oh, okay. So the mentors I thought, who I trusted, who then wanted to fuck me, and now they've completely turned on me, I'm just going to do my own thing. And that's when I started to want to combine musical theater and comedy. It was only after that happened, and I kind of rejected them as my mentors.
Oh, and then that's when you started to move towards the videos?
The videos came a couple years later.
But how did you start to fuse them without them? Did you start going to perform other places? Was this just a mental thing?
I took a musical theater writing class.
Yeah.
And,
oh, that's good.
And then, this was after graduating, I wanted to have a show running at UCB. Because that's the status symbol. If you have a show running at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater...
In the basement of the supermarket?
Yeah, you're done. You're in. You're in. You might as well be famous. I mean, that's really how I saw it. And I was doing a sketch. I was working out the sketch show, and one of the sketches in it was a song about the movie Space Jam.
Yeah.
And I wrote it with my friend, and I played it for my boyfriend, who's now my husband. I've been with my husband for 10 years.
Yeah.
I played it for my husband, and he went, you should just be doing this for the show.
Well, that's interesting, though. You must have been one of the only people. I don't know, but I don't, you know, you're one of the kids. I'm old. I mean, but it seems that what you do, I've not really seen it in, like, I mean, were there other people doing musical comedy sketch shit?
No. No, and it felt so obvious to me, because it seemed like there was a gap in musical theater. When I tried to find a comedy audition song, it was just these lame songs,
old ones,
especially
right?
For women. Either old ones or just like songs that were funny adjacent.
Well, I think that also,
funny.
Like, you know, until Glee, it wasn't particularly popular anymore.
No, but I mean, I didn't know that. And when you're in the musical theater community, it's always popular. I mean, Glee's all, first of all, Glee's all covers, so that. No,
but I mean, but just, you know, cultural resonance outside of Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
It just wasn't happening.
No.
Right.
No, and so that's why I'm going for, I mean, even now with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, it's a cult show.
Oh, in terms of who the people who love it?
Yeah. Like, when people love it, they love it, and... But there are still a bunch of people who hear it's a musical and won't watch it.
Okay,
hope they die.
Let's not get there yet. So he says you should only be doing this.
He's not only, but he said for this sketch show, this is way more unique than just doing sketches.
Right.
And so then I made my first musical sketch show, and I just felt it click.
UCB?
Yeah, and I fell in love with it, and I thought, okay, I want to be my own kind of one-stop shop comedy. I want to write my own shit and star in my own shit.
Yeah.
And I want that to be, I want to be my own one person sketch group.
Yeah.
So I'd seen people doing internet sketches and I thought, okay, what can I do? And I had a song that I'd written in college that I didn't know what to do with called Fuck Me, Ray Bradbury. It was when I was thinking of sketches to do and a song popped into my head. And I said, oh, that could actually make a really great first sketch as a music video. And so I made it for $2,000. And not, because you don't set out to make a viral video. That doesn't make any sense.
No, you can't.
I made a video that I thought would be a great comedy calling card. And it went super viral and got me representation.
Yeah, that was 2010.
2010, yeah.
Yeah, because I started this in 2009.
Yeah.
And, but it's interesting that... Even then, though, I mean, it went viral and that, you know, brought you attention. But that was like we started, even though YouTube had been around a bit and podcasting had been around a bit, it was just there was this moment.
Yeah.
Where you could break out of it. Now, of course, you have people that are specifically YouTube or only podcasts or whatever. But there was a bit of a moment where you could break and you set that standard in a way. So like hundreds of young people because of you were like, you just got to put the video up.
Well, and the cool thing, and the thing was, the thing that set me apart, I think, is because we were just coming out of, so the Landlord Funny or Die sketch happened in, I want to say 2007, maybe 2006, and it kind of had this grainy home video quality to it. And so most sketches at that time were that.
Yeah.
I had seen other people use great cinematography. And there was the cinematographer in New York, Paul Rondeau, who was his one-stop shop.
Right.
He had all his own equipment.
Yeah.
And so when I wanted to do a music video, I thought, what if I make it look good like some of these other videos that I've seen? So I think that when I released that music video, it was also unique in that it looked great.
Yeah, it looks great.
And
yeah.
It looks professional.
Yeah.
And that's just because I got a
doesn't
great...
Doesn't take much to do that, right? That's what people... That always gets me about podcasting. It's like, you just need a good mic, man.
Yeah.
Don't get the fucking snowball and sit it in the middle, whatever.
But even now, I mean, the cameras...
Yeah, even on the phone, right?
Well, now, I mean, the phones are better than... Yeah. We have a Canon 7D. The phone... Yeah. My husband's new phone is better.
So that then that's history. So you got representation,
and that's history.
And you wrote a spec script, but it didn't like it took Crazy Ex-Girlfriend to really put the whole vision together.
It was kind of a slow burn because I was a working. So after I got hired for my first gig,
writing
for which I'm eternally grateful. By the way, I was
the cartoon
kvetching about it earlier, but yeah, I'm eternally grateful for that. I kept writing for TV. I wrote for Robot Chicken. You had Seth on here.
Yeah.
He's the fucking best.
Nice guy.
And I just kept writing for TV and various award shows. But then I was also, I did another UCB show. Yeah. Of
here.
Yeah. And I kept doing music videos that I was paying money that I was paying for out of what I earned as a TV writer.
Right.
And so it was those videos that this woman, Aline Brosh McKenna, saw 5 years ago at this point. And she is this big deal screenwriter. She wrote The Devil Wears Prada.
Oh, I like that movie.
Yeah. And she called me in for a general meeting at CBS and she said, I want to write a musical TV show with you. And I'd already pitched.
She found you?
1,000%. Yeah.
For the videos, though, again.
And no one could have, it wasn't my rep sending me around because no one had really, I was doing the musical thing and they knew it was good, but you can't. I'd pitched 2 musical TV shows. No one gave a shit.
And you were doing relatively low profile writing jobs.
Yeah.
So you guys put this show together. She finds you.
Yeah.
And you do.
And she had the idea for a movie called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yeah.
And we thought that would be a great show because she was saying that all of my videos were, there was always this moment of sadness. They were all very, they were out there, but they were very emotional. And so that idea really worked and we developed it together. And
you had emotional sadness and emotional menace. And then you get a great, funny character.
Actually, that's very true. It's dead on. Emotional sadness and emotional menace.
So hot.
Dennis the emotional menace is less of a trickster, but he's more insidious.
Yeah. So and then the rest is like, you know, you did, it's doing great. You're doing what, one more season?
One more season. We're on the final season.
And you won a Golden Globe and a Critics' Choice and another one.
A Television Critics Association. Have
it's
you been
great.
To that one?
Yeah, I went. I did go to that one. And I like the SAG Awards.
That's the one. That's the Golden Goose I can't get.
Oh, I just liked being there the most. I you know, because like I'd interviewed a lot of the people and now I was there as an actor and I felt like I was part of a community. It was nice. And Frances McDormand came up to me and told me, I love you on that show.
Oh, that's like, so cool.
And I'm like, oh, I kind of won.
That's fucking awesome.
I won.
Though moments like that are where you really win. I mean, the awards are wonderful, but the first person who emailed me after I won the Golden Globe was Carol Burnett.
Oh, my God.
That was my win.
That's
that was
great.
My Golden Globe.
Exactly.
Like, that done.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
That's great. And, you know, I watch the show, and I like it. Because I'm the kind of person I am, I would probably categorize it as a guilty pleasure.
Sure. Uh-huh. Well, dig into that. Why?
Because, like, I'd like to think that, like, I don't know if this show's really for me, but I enjoy it. Do you know what I mean?
So interesting. Why would the show not be for you?
Because, you know, you're singing.
It's funny because we get in, because I assume you've watched a couple episodes of season one. Season three is all about, we get way more into mental illness, and I have a suicide attempt, and my character's diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
You don't have that, do you?
No, I don't have borderline. Mm. But I have intimate knowledge of, I know people with it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
it's rough.
It's really interesting.
That's why I could see that from the ones I've watched, that would be where it would go. But you didn't have that arc set up early on, did you?
We knew something was going on. The interesting thing about borderline is it's a heightened, it's basically someone with no emotional skin. It's someone who always has these, it feels like they have third degree burns. They're so hypersensitive. And so I have aspects of that. We all do. Hmm. And it's stuff that we do just heightened, which is what borderline is. So we always knew she had heightened aspects of stuff that I'd had and other people had had,
but also truly incapable of real emotional connection.
Yeah.
And very black and white thinking.
Yes.
And manipulative horror show.
Yes. Yeah. And the splitting. I've started to rewatch a little of season one, and I'm actually surprised.
There.
We're like, oh, she's ill.
Yeah.
Oh, she's very ill. And then, you know, there's that character there's a character who keeps, you know, wanting to fuck her, this character Greg. I'm like, dude. And it's later revealed, spoiler alert, he's an alcoholic. And in season two, he goes through like a program.
There's no reason I should, you know, I forget, because like even the show I'm on, you know, Glow, that there's a lot of heavy shit going on. But because there's wrestling, you don't process the same way. And because there's music, you're not processing, because like if I really think about the first few episodes where you're basically, you know, just sexually abusing that guy.
Yep.
That like, it's like, oh, this is
yeah.
horrible, but oh, she's singing.
And there's a sheen over it. Now, here's a question I would pose to you, not to get controversial, is if you see both theoretically Glow and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend as things that you would call guilty pleasures, right? There are things that you theoretically enjoy.
I haven't put much thought into
it. But I wonder if there's a little bit of that is because it's shows created by and starring women. I'm not saying that it's you, but I think that men see female content, even if it's on a deep subconscious level, as fluffy. But I wonder generally about...
I think that's a good question, because like I talked to a lot of dudes about Glow, and they're like, I wasn't going to watch it.
Yeah, why?
And then...
Why, man?
Because of that.
Sure. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, but that's not... We didn't just crack a code.
No. That's true. Oh, we've got it. Sometimes men don't like women.
Yeah.
But why...
I just think it's a relatability thing.
Sure.
That, you know, I don't think it's, I'm sure there's levels of it that might be insidious, but I think a lot of it's sort of like, it's not for me. You know what I mean? Like, that might just be encultured, and I don't even think it's misogynistic.
But the labeling, and I'm not saying this is necessarily you, but the sometimes content that has women in it and is created by women and seems, quote unquote, female, is labeled as fluff. And you see...
Oh, I didn't think that, yeah.
But you
okay,
see that.
You. Yeah.
You see that... In every kind of aspect of art, things that take on things that are
geared true.
For women.
My girlfriend's a painter, and she, you know, she gets mislabeled like that.
Yep.
It, you know, that it's sort of, it's lighter. It's this, and it just, you know, it's drives her crazy.
And it's just because it's not for the mainstream gaze. I mean, we did.
Or the market.
Or
it's like they're determining it. I mean, the market itself, the people that make those decisions, are acting out of, you know, either, you know, it's a principle or whatever, or they believe the market is this way or that way. But it's not always about, like, the audience. You know, there's people making those decisions.
Sure.
You know?
But nine times out of ten, those people are male.
Sure. No, right.
But the interesting thing, I mean, you see it, we did it with
can I
entertainment.
Can I interrupt you some more?
Yeah, please. Do it. Tell me why I'm wrong. But for years, we've done it with entertainment that we see is, oh, well, that's for, you know, black people.
Right. No, I hear
and,
you.
And the way that you see, like, oh, well, stuff that was on UPN or BET or Tyler Perry, well, that's fluff. Like, it's in the same way people sometimes think of female.
I guess so. It's weird. I never noticed that, because I always think, like, it's either, like, you know, maybe it's not for me, but I don't think it's fluff, or it's for kids.
Uh-huh.
It's either not for me, it's either for kids, or it's like, that seems to be a show that other people would enjoy who live that life.
I think that's one way to look at it, but I think there is also a labeling of anything that isn't the right. mainstream story is less legitimate. It's less legitimate of a story, and it's a niche product.
Right.
And
well, everything's a niche now, so it's hard to make.
Well, work. Exactly. And that's why it's great, and that's why, you know, peak TV is so great. I mean, that's what I'm really feeling, is breaking out of what's, you know, legitimate, what isn't. I mean, I think that everyone, I was at the Vanity Fair dinner for the Oscars. And
big shot.
I know, right? And the only time people stopped talking,
yeah,
when Frances McDormand won, was talking about inclusion writers. Yeah. But when Jordan Peele won for Get Out,
yeah,
and when Get Out was maybe gonna win,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
because even a couple years ago, that movie wouldn't have been seen as legitimately, let alone that it was conceived by a comedian, which comedies are always seen as less legitimate, and Get Out's not a comedy. But
that's pretty funny.
When you think about something like the idea of things not being as legitimate because they're not about a king learning not to stutter, white king learning not to stutter.
No, it wasn't a great movie.
What?
It wasn't a great movie.
I actually really love that movie.
Nice.
Yeah. I actually really love that movie. But when I saw that movie, I went, well, that's a prototypical Oscar movie.
Sure.
And I think that those lines are starting to blur, and that includes content created by
many
women
voices.
For women. Yeah. Exactly. And it's refreshing.
Good.
But that's why I take umbrage with the term guilty pleasure. Now, in the case you're saying it makes sense because it's musicals, but I think that sometimes is code for seeing something meant for a specific group of people.
It's like, well, it's not like legitimate. You said, like, your inverted, not inverted misogyny, but
internalized misogyny.
Well, I think that it's a version of that, you know, that like they can't, and it's also a version of, some of it might just have to be with posturing. Because I know, you know, many sort of evolved people that, you know, don't necessarily want to cop to liking Journey, the band.
Sure.
So like, I think some of it just has to do with not having the balls or the, to support something like that.
Uh-huh. Like, I love the band Fun. I know a lot of people who are like, oh.
Antonoff's band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that band.
Yeah, he's kind of a pop wizard.
I know some other people who are like, they just generally don't like a pop sound.
I like Steel Train. I like his other band, the Grateful Dead band that he was in.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no, I know exactly. I think some of it's that. But we don't have to solve this now. I think we should take a few minutes. I hear your husband made a movie.
Nice segue. Yeah, my husband made a movie. And I'm in it, and he co-wrote it. And it's great.
I watched about half.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't because it was bad. I just, you know, I didn't get the fucking screener till this morning for some reason. Don't go yelling at anybody. It's good that I only watch half because it is sort of a suspense, you know, it's a murder mystery. And I can't spoil it because I don't fucking know what happened yet.
Great.
But I like Adam Pauly a lot, and you're great.
Yeah.
And it looked great. It was shot nicely. He directed it?
Yeah, he directed it and then co-wrote it with the guy who plays Dwayne, who has that chin beard.
Oh, yeah,
that's
totally.
My husband's writing partner
that's
and producing
funny.
Partner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But it looks great. And I've seen a lot of indie movies that are comedies and like that you're just sort of like, oh, these characters aren't going to hold up.
Yeah.
There's a problem with comedies of any kind where, you know, they don't consider the integrity of the character and it gets diminished for the comedy.
That's very, yeah. That's right. Very important to both me, and that's something that my husband and I definitely connect on, is not selling out emotion for a joke.
Yeah, no, and it looked great. And is that Billy Eichner for a minute?
Yeah.
He plays the rabbi?
Yeah.
And you have rabbis in your family?
My cousin is a rabbi, yes.
Progressive rabbi?
He's a progressive conservative rabbi, so whatever that means.
Right, right. So not reform.
Where's a yarmulke but supports gay marriage?
Yeah, center of okay, I got
yeah.
It. But yeah, no, I think it looks great, and
thank you.
I appreciated the long sort of pan shot at the beginning. What do you call it, a tracking shot?
Tracking shot, yeah.
I know that he was like, you know, I'm going to do this.
You could tell that he was like, and this is the tracking shot.
Yeah, this is like the opening tracking shot, like the Orson Welles Touch of Evil, and then the player did a riff on it. This is my riff on the tracking shot. That really has nothing to do with the rest of the film.
And here's the thing I'll say about that. It actually does. The tracking shot comes back. The idea of the tracking shot does come back visually. Oh, okay. It's called back at the end of the film.
Oh, so bookends. So like, get, see?
He's pretty fucking great.
You spoiled it. I did.
Exactly.
You spoiled it for the film nerds.
Spoiler alert.
You're going to get into the tracking shot talk.
That opening image is going to come back in the closing
I liked
image.
It. Yeah, it's funny. And like, I think Adam Pauly's funny. I think he's like got a... I've seen him in other things. I've seen him in Baena's movies.
Yeah, so he used to be writing partners with my husband and Doug, who's in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the three of them were a sketch writing team called Chubby Skinny Kids.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now Pally's kind of gotten, has this acting career, and so they wrote this part for him.
Yeah, he's like, I feel like I've seen him grow up or something.
Yeah, and he's a really, the thing is, he kind of has this like a, you know, he has this irreverent persona. He just did that thing at the Shorty Awards. We took down the Shorty Awards, which I thought was hilarious. But in person, he's also very, very kind and
Jewish
very
guy?
Sweet. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Jersey, maybe?
Jersey. Lived in Jersey by way of Chicago, I think. Yeah. And he has three kids, and he is married to his high school sweetheart.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And this takes place in Long Island? Is it Long Island?
Yeah, yeah, my husband's from Long Island.
But he's not a Jew, right?
Oh, super Jew. He was raised Conservadox. He was raised to not celebrate Halloween.
Really?
Yeah, he went to yeshiva until he was 14. He would get.
Well, look at you marrying a Jew.
I know, it's terrible. It's terrible because we all descend from 350 people 8 years ago. Eight hundred years ago.
I like 8 years.
Eight years ago.
Recent? This is one of those conspiracy theories?
Yeah, 8 years ago.
It all happened 8 years ago.
8 years ago, the fossils came up.
In the simulation we're living, yeah.
Yeah, well, that could have happened. We could have been created 5 seconds ago, okay, and we're all just implanted with these memories. Oh, yeah, he's falling asleep. he was raised super Jew. I mean, you know, he and I both dated non-Jews, and I don't know. We're both ashamed of it.
Wow, shame.
I'm not shame. It's just much as like, oh, we're so progressive and cool. We could have done so much more instead of make his parents happy.
Mm-hmm.
His parents are thrilled, and it's like, oh,
of course,
great.
Everyone's thrilled, right?
Everyone's thrilled. The state of Israel's thrilled.
Really? You don't know.
No, we've been to Israel. They're thrilled.
Oh, they are?
Yes.
They're hoping you're going to come there, send money.
Oh, we went there right before the election, and everyone said to us, and this is weird because a lot of Israelis support Trump, but they said, hey, well, maybe you come here and you make TV in Tel Aviv. No, yeah. And we're like, oh, we're pretty happy in America. And they go, hey, with Trump coming, you may have to come here. They were almost psyched for another Holocaust. It was very weird.
You might have to come
here. You might have to come here.
So that's the new pitch. It's not like we're always here for all Jews. It's like, guess what?
Guess what? It's
<You're> coming.
In Hebrew, I think the show is called Haiksi Tamitarefet.
Which is?
Crazy ex-girlfriend. But I think it literally means like insane person I used to date.
Oh, and they like it in Israel?
I think so. Jews in general seem to like it.
Okay, good. Well, then I'm glad you're making them happy. That's no small task.
Oh, I know.
It was great talking to you.
It was great talking to you.
Do you feel satisfied?
Too.
Did we do what we needed to do?
For plugging the movie at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
There you go. A couple of Jews sitting around talking. Okay? Everybody okay with that? This is where the guitar is going to be soon. Boomer lives!